Today we shall speak about healing. In the previous session, we were speaking about happiness, and we were speaking about how an inner state of emptiness that we experience for various reasons, we will go into those reasons today, can compel us to find happiness in various things in the world, and then we go after it. And in that process of finding happiness in the world, be it through small, momentary, sensory pleasures, or be it through finding a sense of meaning in activity, we may sometimes end up compromising on our values, going against our inner values. And then we also become dependent on these external things for giving us a sense of happiness that further weakens the soul. And today we will go a little bit deeper into this experience of emptiness, what we mean by that, how it is created, and we will of course look at it in the context of healing. When we speak of healing, of course, we are looking at some state that is not natural. And healing is a process through which we return something that has gone out of its natural state back to its original state. And that's what we normally speak about as healing. And we speak of healing of the body, healing of the mind. So when we speak of healing, obviously, we are referring to some form of disease. So when we speak about the body, bodily diseases, we have many diseases, from very severe diseases like cancer and AIDS and many other illnesses, to simple things like the common cold, some viral infection or a cough. That is also a disease. And the word disease is quite interesting. Do you know why? It's made up of actually two words. Dis-ease. And the meaning is actually pretty simple. It means not at ease. So when I'm not at ease, I am diseased. Right? So it comes from that. We, of course, try and understand it in the context of some severe illnesses. But when I have a common cold or a common cough, that is also a disease. I'm not at ease. I'm not comfortable. And then I take steps so that I return from the state of disease to a state of ease and comfort. And to return to the state of ease, obviously, there has to be some process of healing. So what do we need? What causes a disease? Any disease? What causes a disease? Let's take up things like the common cough, cold, fever, some infection. What causes the disease? Or a severe disease like cancer or something like that. What initiates a disease? Infection. Some infection. Some infection that is affecting the body. So people speak of trauma. It's a very strong word, trauma. But trauma is obviously something that affects the body and or the mind in some way and takes it away from its natural state of ease. So when we are looking at physical illnesses, yes, some infection of the body, and we think of healing that, what do we need to do to heal anything that is there in the body? Let's look at the bodily illnesses first. What do we need? What do you think? You all had some illnesses, some problems here and there. What do we need to heal the problem?
Medicine.
Medicine, yes, of course.
Love.
So we need love. Yes, of course, we need a lot of love. So I also, first of all, I may need medicine for some things. I need the recognition that the illness is there. Yes, I need recognition. I need the realization the illness is there. And then I also need the knowledge of what is needed, which doctor to meet, what medicine to take. I need that information. I need that knowledge. I need recognition. So we can say one of the things that I will certainly need is recognition, realization, knowledge. The other thing that someone mentioned is care, love, but in the form of care, I need to take care of the body in certain ways. What else do I need? I may also need to maintain some cleanliness, obviously. So if there is a wound that has to be clean, if it is not clean, that complicates matters a lot more. And especially when we are looking at some injury or wound, say there is a fracture or there is some injury to the muscle, I also need to give it some rest so that it has the chance to heal. So we can speak about some sort of rest that I need to give the body so that it takes care of itself. So these are things that we do. So anyway, this is not obviously a talk of physical healing. Though, of course, from a spiritual perspective, we know that even in physical diseases like cancer, etc., the practice of certain spiritual processes like meditation are very useful. That we know there are plenty of studies on that. In this organization at Mount Abu, we have, in the international headquarters, we have a hospital. It's a multi-specialty hospital. And there is a lot of research going into the effect of meditation on diseases like coronary artery disease, that is heart disease. And diabetes and things like that. So we know when you practice meditation, because you are practicing the process of giving it some rest and many other things, it helps even physical diseases. Today, of course, we will look at more the inner psychological aspects of the mind. So when we look at diseases of the mind, when the mind is not at ease, in extreme forms, of course, we have all the psychological disorders. You have the various forms of anxiety disorders, mood disorders, schizophrenic disorders, personality disorders, extreme forms, which most of us may not necessarily be experiencing at least all the time. But what about these subtle diseases of the mind? Like for the body, you have the common cold, the common cough. What are these subtle diseases of the mind that give us an indication that there is a problem?
Stress.
The experience of stress. What else? Then I'm not at ease, yes? So any disease obviously creates some form of suffering. Physical or psychological. Some of the expressions are, of course, you mentioned stress. What else can we experience, yes?
Depression
or sadness. In more severe cases, depression, some would say anger, anxiety, and many others. We can keep adding all these negative states that we experience. Obviously, we are not at ease. That is, in some way, I have moved away from a natural state. Like the body moves away from a natural state, and it is called a disease. I have moved away from some natural state inside, which is also a disease of the mind. That natural state we will look at a little later. So this we are quite aware of, and we would like to remove it. However, there are other very subtle expressions and experiences of the suffering of the mind. So being not at ease, is it always expressed through these very obvious negative states? Or it can also be expressed through certain states that appear to be positive, but are actually deceptive. And which is an indication that I have moved away from my state of ease. You're saying something here?
Yeah.
What
you call people get
manic?
Yeah.
Okay, that's an extreme form again. Yeah, but then we all have our experiences of mania. Excitement. So one of the things that we can look at today, the experience of excitement. It could be, come to that. Excitement, it could be about a holiday. Excitement, it could be about some work. But something, some excitement. You were saying something?
I just thought being in love.
Very interesting. Infatuation. Very, very you said being in love. So again, I have really moved away from a state of ease. I'm not at ease. There is an excitement. There is an agitation. You were saying something?
Separation.
Separation. Yeah. Separation. What do you mean by that?
Like that you're not a part of the whole.
Moving away, like for example, even separating yourself in relationship or from activity.
From activity or from that your mind that you think that you are not.
Okay, sort of an isolation, separation.
Yeah,
is that a positive state? Would you experience that as a positive state? No, so that would probably come somewhere here.
Yeah.
But I'm running out of space, so I can't keep adding. I wish this was larger and I was taller and all that. So infatuation, passion. You know, this I'm so passionate about something. And many of you may know the word passion actually comes from the Greek word for suffering. It comes from the Greek word for suffering. I don't exactly remember the word, but you can look up on the web. You go to Wikipedia and you'll have the descriptions there. The word anger actually, the passion comes from the Greek word for suffering, to suffer, the verb to suffer. The word anger comes from the Old Norse word for suffering, which is anger. This is also a sort of an expression. So people, you know, probably the wise people in the olden days recognized that there is some suffering. And therefore you also have this movie, The Passion of Christ. You know about this movie? It's not about any temptation of Christ. It's the suffering of Christ from the time he was captured to the crucifixion. That's called The Passion of Christ. So many of these states we may think are very, very positive, but actually it's the soul crying out for something and moving away from a state of ease. In English, there is an old saying. Many of you may have heard it. Empty vessels make a lot of noise. Mm-hmm. You heard that? I think there's a similar saying in Danish as well. Yeah. Isn't it? There you go. So in some ways, this is like the soul creating a lot of noise. Something calling out for something. And here we have this understanding of these being responses to an inner state of emptiness, whatever it may be. And the way we define emptiness is an experience of A, incompleteness, and B, a sense of insecurity. So because there is a sense of incompleteness, I have these excitement, these passions, these infatuations, and I'm trying to make myself complete in some way. Because there is a sense of insecurity, I feel the stress, I feel the anxiety, I feel the sadness because of a sense of loss. And so then, this becomes a big motivation behind both these expressions of what is, as we understand it, an experience of suffering, where we have moved away from a state of ease into a state of disease. So, what do we do now? Is it okay to give in to the passions and excitement and anything wrong with that really?
No?
It gives life a lot of colors, right? But at the same time, we know when we are taken over by these passions and infatuations, they also become the source of our suffering. So here it is not a question of denial, but a question of transformation, of course. We will look into that a little later. But let us try and see, first of all, where do these come from? When we speak about disease, there is a movement away from the natural state of ease or fullness, if you can call it that. To a state of emptiness. But looking at the soul and looking at the experiences of the mind and how we express our emptiness in these ways, what is the trauma that is making us respond in these ways? Where does it come from? Where does any trauma come from?
From your mind.
From the mind, but how does the mind experience the trauma? One is the trauma of the body, which is obviously there is some experience that I have had, yes? And that experience has moved the body away from its state of natural ease. In forms of an accident or an injury or an infection. But we are looking at the state of the mind. So So what is it that creates trauma in the mind? We of course have many experiences of the past. Many of the experiences of the past we know. Some are of course conscious, but there is a line from the conscious to the unconscious. These experiences are related both to the self and to others. We know that usually it is very difficult to remember things before the age of 5. Very few things we remember. There are some flashes. Most things are not remembered. Even after the age of 5, there are many experiences that we may choose to forget. And so they become unconscious. But that does not mean that they go away. We know psychology has explained it very, very well. They continue to operate. And if we do not acknowledge them, if we do not recognize them, they manifest in different forms. There are some experiences that are quite conscious. We remember some traumatic experiences of the past, of having been told something or someone having behaved in a certain way with me, which we carry with us, which is very conscious and painful, and it makes us and gives us various experiences of suffering. But the trick, of course, is also to understand that not all of my experiences, and therefore not all the trauma, comes from those experiences I remember, but there can be many that can be unconscious. Let me illustrate with a case, a very famous case from the history of psychology. It's one of the cases of Freud. So, very famous case. So there was this case of this woman. She had a sister. There were two sisters. So they went out. She was not married. Her sister was married. And they all decided to have a vacation together. That is, the two sisters and the sister's husband. They decided to have a vacation together. And so they went out somewhere for a nice vacation. And the sister, one of the sisters who was married, she was not well. She was going through some problems, physical problems. So she decided to stay home one evening because she was not feeling well. And her sister and, of course, the brother-in-law, they decided, okay, let's go out for a little walk. And they went out for a nice long walk. As they were walking, they started speaking to each other. And this lady found out that, you know, there were a lot of similarities between her and her brother-in-law, sister's husband. And she felt a sort of a romantic attraction towards her sister's husband. Now, that immediately brought a sense of guilt. He's my sister's husband, you know, how can I feel like this towards him? That brought a feeling of guilt, which was quite unbearable because she was brought up in a very strong, very conservative, disciplined family. So this sense of guilt was pushed out of consciousness. This is how the ego tries to defend itself against anxiety. So I experience anxiety. Anxiety is painful. So how do I deal with anxiety? And there are different ways that we deal with anxiety. One is depression. Push it out of consciousness. It's not there. I'm free. I'm a good girl. See, I'm a good girl because I don't have any such dirty feelings. There are various ways that I can defend myself against anxiety. One is depression. The other could be projection. And then there is, you know, projection is, there is an inner reality I see outside in the world. So I may be infatuated with someone, but I'm seeing everybody around me being infatuated with someone or the other. Or maybe being infatuated with me. Or I see the slightest familiarity between two people. Ah, something is going on between them. Projection. Because I'm not comfortable with my own feelings. I project them onto the world. By projecting them onto the world, I tell myself, I'm okay, the problem is out there. They are dirty, they are bad, I'm okay. That could be one way that the ego defends itself. Another could be reaction formation. Reaction formation is expressing the opposite of what I'm actually feeling. So I'm feeling infatuation towards someone, but that creates anxiety. And to defend myself from the anxiety, I start expressing anger or hatred towards the other. I express the opposite. Dislike. Then I'll criticize. I'll say a few bad things about that person to tell myself, no, I don't really feel anything good for that person. That person is just, that could be another expression. So there are so many ways. There could be another expression called displacement, where if I feel something towards someone or some situation and that is creating anxiety, that effect is displaced to something that is more acceptable. It can also come out of guilt. So I feel a sort of an infatuation towards someone and that creates guilt, and then I sort of displace it, and then I try to express it maybe with extra love towards my wife, and try to overcome that guilt that I'm feeling because of the experience. So various ways in which the ego will defend itself against anxiety, but it doesn't really serve the purpose because that's an artificial defense. I have just pushed away that experience into the unconscious, and because I have not recognized it and worked with it, that will continue to operate. So now look at this woman, very interesting case. So she felt that I should, that attraction towards a brother-in-law repressed into the unconscious because that is creating a lot of anxiety. And then, okay, they went back home and it was all fine. She went back to her hometown, her sister and her sister's husband, they returned to their own hometown. After a few weeks, she got the message that her sister was very seriously ill, almost like on her deathbed. So obviously, she had a lot of love for her sister. So she went to her sister's place. And she took care of her sister for some time, for a few weeks. But her sister it was irreversible, the disease of the body. And after some time, her sister passed away. The moment her sister passed away and she got the message that her sister has passed away, she was in the house and she learned from the doctor that her sister is no more. The first thought that entered her mind was, now he's free to marry me. See, so now what has happened is, because of the repression, that simple infatuation has taken a huge size, a big proportion, because you keep something pressed down, it's going to gather more and more energy. Like you've had that, you turn a container upside down and you push it under, try to put it under water, it will just bounce out. So a simple experience of infatuation that she has pressed below the surface of consciousness, keeping it pressed because it's creating anxiety, it just burst out in this thought, oh, now he's free to marry me. And that created even more severe anxiety. Obviously, because that is terrible. My sister has just passed away. I learned about it right now, and I'm thinking about marrying my brother-in-law. That creates even more intense anxiety. And that is also repressed and pushed away. And she wasn't aware of what the mind was doing. Huh? That was repressed and pushed away. After that, in a few days, she started developing severe pain in her legs. And in some time, she lost all sensation of her legs. Paralysis. No medical history. No injury. Nothing. Paralysis. This is what is referred to as hysteria. Hysterical neurosis. Now they call it conversion disorder in psychology. It was called hysteria. And the earlier understanding was that only women got it. But there are also men who had it. And the father of modern medicine, as we understand it, Hippocrates, the Greek practitioner, Hippocrates, he had a very interesting theory about hysteria. You might want to hear it. Do you know this theory? Hysteris, in Greek, is the womb. Yeah, the womb. So Hippocrates' theory was, if the womb is not put to its right use, that is to bear babies, it starts wandering around different parts of the body. And then whichever part it goes to, that part gets affected and that gets diseased. So that's hysterical neurosis. So the treatment for hysteria, according to Hippocrates, was get the woman married, let her have children, everything will be okay. So how does it happen with men? We don't know. But they don't have a hysteris within them. That was the old theory. But of course, in modern times, in the last century, we understand that it's not something that is exclusive to women. Even men experience it. For example, during the Second World War, many pilots became blind. Now, why did they become blind? Nothing happened. No medical injury, nothing, no disease. They just become blind. Gives them a defense against the anxiety of feeling afraid. So a pilot, a soldier, supposed to be brave. You know, I'm supposed to defend my country. All these things that are created around the machismo of the soldier. Go and admit that I'm afraid to go and fly and die. No, no. And because this is not recognized, it is pushed away into the unconscious. It gets converted to this conversion disorder. It takes a physical form. And therefore. So this girl, going back to this girl. Paralysis of the legs. Now, why did this become paralysis of the legs? She had the womb in the legs. Interesting. I think Hippocrates would be very happy with that explanation. He might give you very good grades as well if he was teaching you. Any idea why it got converted into that form, this anxiety?
The walk with the man.
Because it started when she was walking with that man. You see? See the crazy way in which the mind can work. She started having those feelings when she was walking with the man. And because those feelings were repressed, every time she walked, that reminded her of those guilty experiences, anxiety-laden experiences. So I want to forget that I ever felt like this. I want to forget that I ever felt like this. Then I want to forget all the activities associated with that feeling. And the activity that was associated with that feeling was walking. Dissociate myself from that activity, I find a release from anxiety. This is an actual case. And then of course when she came and she started discovering through, initially Freud used to practice a little bit of hypnosis, but also through some other processes, she started recognizing the reason of the anxiety. She started recognition, the knowledge. And as she started, all those repressed experiences started becoming conscious, slowly, slowly the problem went away. She started gaining sensation in her legs again, she was able to walk. But obviously that had to be done in an environment of care. Now she was afraid of speaking about it because obviously that is sin and that is bad, and you know, a good girl cannot feel like that. In a therapeutic relationship, you have an environment of safety and security, and it doesn't matter, it is not conditional. The respect and love that you get is not conditional. And that environment of care enabled her to recognize that problem. And when she started accepting that, realizing that this is actually the problem and the guilt associated with those feelings, the problem went away. Not only did the problem go away, but she recognized that actually there was really nothing. It's not that she continued to feel like that towards her brother-in-law, nothing. When she brought these feelings into her consciousness, she realized that it was just a crush. And you know, it passes, there's nothing. But because that was not recognized, pushed away, it gathered steam, became so strong. And then took over her life in that particular way. This is, of course, a more extreme example. Most of us don't have paralysis of the legs or blindness of the eyes, but the process can many times be very, very similar. We have some experiences with the self and with others, but of course, any experience with the other is also a reflection of the self. And it tells me something about me. And if that experience creates a sense of guilt, I can push it out of consciousness and it will remain in the unconscious, but it will not remain comfortably there. It will keep operating and pushing me and making me do things that I don't fully understand. Compulsions, obsessions. And because of that, I experience the experience of trauma. And then, of course, I move to a state of disease and I experience myself in different ways. Let us take a more simple example from a more normal case. No conversion disorder. But this was a girl that I had the experience of meeting and working with many, many, many years ago. Maybe 10 years ago. But it was a very interesting case. She was very, very intelligent, very capable, and but she had this experience, she had these two symptoms, if you see the external symptoms, and she would spend some time in a certain experience, some time in another experience. The first experience was this obsession with cleanliness. Everything has to be clean, sterile clean, you know, very, very clean. Everything has to be clean, a small dot on the cloth is also not good, and you know, very, very clean. And then she would spend some time in that experience, and then she would radically shift to another experience where everything would be very untidy. Everything is thrown away around in the house, she doesn't have a bath for a few days, she deliberately wears clothes in a way that is clumsy, deliberately, you know? So if you would normally tuck in something, she would have it half tucked in, half like this, and deliberately, and she wouldn't have a bath, she wouldn't brush her teeth, her hair would be unkempt, and she would spend some time like this, and then she would feel guilty and then move back to this, and then feel suffocated and then move back to this, and this was like a yo-yo, a swing from this experience to this experience, and sometimes she would be like this for a few months even, and just for some time, sometimes for a few weeks, and this was going on for some time, and this was
quite uncomfortable for her, obviously, because that is not natural. It's out of a state of balance. And she came in, and we spoke about many things. And slowly, slowly, she started speaking about some experiences of her childhood, which were quite painful. One experience, which was probably the most dominant out of all the experiences, was an experience of sexual abuse. And by someone that she trusted very deeply. It was her father's brother, an uncle. And it was very, very painful because as we explored the whole process, we discovered that there was a lot of love for that person, a lot of faith in that person. That person had also done a lot for her in terms of taking care of her. Her father did not have a good job, so all that. He'd done a lot for her, so there was this gratitude, there was this love for all that he had done for her. At the same time, there was this anger because there was a betrayal of trust and there was an abuse. But we discovered something very interesting in the process. As we started speaking, initially she was very uncomfortable speaking about it. And then we started speaking about it a little more. And we came across something which was probably very, very essential for that healing process to take place. The recognition of a deep truth. And the truth was this. She was obviously feeling very, very guilty. And we spoke about, okay, the experience of anger, we can understand because I have been, my trust has been betrayed. And this experience of guilt, where is this coming from? And she slowly, very, very painfully, she confronted the reality that she had actually enjoyed those experiences. And that was very painful for her to accept. Because that is taking responsibility. Very, very painful for her to accept. But when she accepted that, she realized that the hate I feel for myself is because I allowed that to happen. I even enjoyed it. And because that enjoyment then brought guilt, and that guilt was then turned towards anger towards the other person. So, of course, there is also this issue of an elder, mature man abusing an innocent child. There is this issue, obviously. But along with that, it was this experience. When she could understand that experience, she could start slowly bringing about transformation. So, yet in the previous class, we were speaking about these dependencies. In our experiences with the world, we obviously have many positive experiences of love and security and peace that we experience from situations and people and things. And obviously, because of that, we start getting attached to these experiences because they're giving us a sense of security and whatever it is that we need. Along with attachment, there is also the desire to have these experiences again and again because they make me feel good. So the experience of protection in a relationship, the experience of security, the experience of being able to use my competencies and qualities, all that we spoke about in the previous session. So we get attached to these because they're giving us something, and then we also have a desire for more of these. These attachments and desire then, of course, create various forms of dependencies and temptations. And if I give in to these dependencies and temptations, I'm creating a trauma because I'm moving away from my state of fullness through these experiences and therefore creating a state of emptiness and then furthering that state of emptiness. So in the case of this girl, let us see what happened. Now in her experiences with life, she comes across this person, father's brother, very loving, he's taking a lot of care of her. So obviously the child, the young girl, is feeling protected, feeling safe, feeling loved, having an experience of self-worth, and she wants to hold on to this experience. So there is a dependency on that attachment to that relationship because it is giving me an experience that is positive. Now, after this person on whom I have become dependent starts abusing that relationship, I let it carry on because I'm afraid of losing that love and security. And she was old enough, she could have, she was like in her teens, she could have stopped it. But because of the fear of losing that relationship on which I have become dependent,
I let it go on. I let it go on. I'm moving away from my, further moving away from my state of fullness and the values of the soul, compromising on my values, causing myself a trauma, leading to a sense of disease, expressed in various forms in my behavior. Now, of course, in the case of this young lady, the connections could be made, and as she could make the connections, as she could recognize, and as she could take the responsibility, she would start then slowly working on the transformation. So the first step obviously would be the recognition of these states. Any reflections at this point? Of course, this is still quite an extreme reaction. But how can we recognize in our own life that I am working, I'm functioning from a state of suffering? So one way, of course, is understanding that whenever there is an agitation, be it even the superficially positive forms of agitation, infatuation, passions, and all the excitements and everything, I can understand that then I'm working from a space of emptiness. And that is because I have moved away from my state of fullness because of various experiences and my dependencies and attachments, and then giving in to the temptations. And every time I give in to the temptations, every time I become dependent, I'm furthering the state of emptiness. And I go on and on and on and on and make it worse for myself. And then, of course, there is a state I reach where things can become quite heavy. There is a feeling of tiredness. Many of us understand depression as a mental disorder. But if we pay attention to our own behaviors, the experience of tiredness, what is that? That is also a form of depression. Not physical tiredness. Physical tiredness, of course, sometimes it's because the body has been pushed beyond certain limits that we can understand. But the sense of emotional tiredness, in extreme cases, the burnout that people experience, that is also an indication that something is not right. Sitting and watching television endlessly, surfing the channels, what is that? It's also an indication of depression. Not finding satisfaction with anything, going on changing, and shaking my leg. Discomfort, disease. Surfing the channel, not finding happiness in anything. It's called, in extreme forms of depression, they call it anhedonia. Inability to experience any pleasure with anything in life. But in simple ways, we were going on searching. All these things are an indication that something is not quite right. Suddenly we get taken over by this feeling of some anxiety, discomfort. Something, the soul is calling out for attention. Something I need to pay attention to. Something that is missing. So in subtle ways, the experience of disease comes out in our life. And so how do we go about bringing about a transformation? The first thing we would, of course, say is the recognition and the realization that there is something that is not quite right. I'm functioning from a state of emptiness and I need to put something in place. I also need, of course, like with a wound, if you're having an operation, surgery, imagine a major surgery. And so what do? They give you a general anesthesia. Why do they give you general anesthesia? You don't feel the pain. And also the body needs to be still. Right? Imagine for under a major operation, the person starts moving around. It would be quite a disaster. So there is this experience of stillness. When we are working with the mind and healing the experiences of the past, also this experience of stillness, like for the body, stillness of the body, for the healing of the mind, stillness of the mind is extremely important, because in that stillness, I can go deep. And in that stillness, that pain can be tolerated. And this is the practice of meditation. So the experience of rest for the body, the experience of stillness for the mind. And in stillness, my concentration improves. With stillness, I can also recognize many patterns that I had not earlier recognized. Because with the concentration, I can see things more clearly. Many benefits come in there. So then there is the state of stillness.
As with the body, I need to make sure that the wound is clean. There has to be that cleanliness. With the mind, it takes the form of honesty. My willingness to actually confront myself, like this brave girl did, of confronting her own guilt, of having given in because she was finding something out of that experience, be it in terms of physical pleasure or be it in terms of having that security in that relationship, but still, my responsibility in some way, and honestly looking at that, which is also an expression of cleanliness. And then, of course, care takes the form of love and also the form of forgiveness. Now, how do we go about having this experience of love and forgiveness for the self first, also for others who I may hold responsible for having wronged me or did, you know, having done wrong things to me? When I have moved away from my inner state of fullness, that is the state, original state of the soul, I have moved away from my values and therefore I lose respect for the self. I lose love for the self. For healing, I need to experience that love. How do we experience love for the self? When I have gone against my values repeatedly over a long period of time. When I have allowed others to use me because I was afraid of losing that relationship. No? I have also met people sometimes who have got into all sorts of abusive relationships again and again because of their fear of losing that relationship. And so they let themselves be used, abused by the other person because they are afraid of letting go. And because of that, then they are deepening their dependencies, their attachments, and also deepening their self-hatred because they are unable to actually do anything about it. They have become victims of their own dependencies and attachments. And then have self-respect. How will they have self-respect? That self-respect has been abused for such a long time. It's very difficult. The injuries are very deep. How do I regain that self-worth, that self-respect? And this is where, as far as spirituality, there are of course many processes associated with that which we can look at. But from the perspective of this process of meditation that we follow, Raj Yoga, where the process of meditation is a connection between the soul and the Supreme, that connection with the Supreme and that experience of unconditional love that we can experience through a connection with God. That no matter what I have done, no matter what has happened to me, I still deserve love. There is someone who will always love me. And very often in psychology, the therapeutic relationship works a little bit like that. Many of you would know that. One of the principles of a therapist is non-judgmental and unconditional respect, unconditional regard for the other person. It doesn't matter what the other person has done. Because without that, it will be very difficult for the other to heal. Already the person, we understand the soul is originally good. So whenever any person has committed any act, there is automatically a feeling of guilt. It could have been pushed away from consciousness, but that feeling is there. But that is very painful to confront. But in a relationship where that person feels accepted, that person will have that strength to confront it and therefore begin the process of healing. How many of you have watched this movie, The Good Will Hunting? You watched it? I would recommend that you watch it. It's a very beautiful movie because of many things, but one particular experience is very, very nice. You know this character played by Matt Damon, that is Will Hunting. Now this boy had been severely physically abused as a child, you know, beaten up, you know, lots of very, very bad things. And then he grows up and he gets into all sorts of very violent activities, you know, just going and beating up people. And he's very talented. He's a genius, you know, mathematics. He's able to see and do many things. But he never used that, and his life was spent in just getting into gangs and fighting and beating up people and all that. After some time, he's assigned a therapist, played by Owen Williams. And this therapist can see the problem. Nothing is wrong with me. I don't need therapy. I'm fine. I'm just a man, you see. Macho. And it's okay to go and beat up people who are evil, so what's wrong? And so he refuses to take part in therapy, but he has to because that's a condition. So he takes part in it and then goes further and further, but there is no real breakthrough. And there is a point of time in the movie where something very interesting happens. So this person is denying those experiences of his childhood, you know, where he was abused very, very badly. And Robin Williams, the therapist, gets all these photographs from the childhood abuse of this boy. And one day in the therapeutic session, he keeps these photographs in front of him. He says, you know, what do you feel about all this? Because he's not coming to that those experiences. Puts them, and then he says, you know, all this has happened to you, and you know, it's okay. And this character Will Hunting says, yeah, it's okay. Then the therapist comes closer to him. He says, you know, it's okay. And then he takes a step back, Will Hunting. He says, yeah, I know, it's okay. Therapist takes a step closer to him. He says, you know, it's really okay. And then Will Hunting takes a further step back. He says, yeah, I know, it's okay. And he goes against the stool. Then the therapist comes closer to him and he says, you know, it's okay. And then he breaks down. He cries, and then, you know, he embraces the therapist, and there is this deep suffering that emerges. And that begins the process of healing. Because intellectually I may understand that I've had some bad experiences where others have behaved in certain ways to me, or I have done some things which were wrong or immoral in my understanding. Intellectually I may understand that. But because the pain, the anxiety associated with those experiences is so severe, I give in to intellectualization, which is another defense mechanism of the ego. I remove myself from the feeling, and I look at these things as an intellectual thing. Oh, yeah, I know why I behave like this, because this happened to me and this happened to me. So it's a very convenient intellectual framework that I've created that gives me a release from anxiety. When I allow myself to feel it, it's very, very painful. But the transformation can happen only when there is this realization, the real feeling, and that is knowledge. Knowledge is not just about some intellectual understanding. But when that realization happens that, this happened, then I have accepted that experience. Otherwise, I'm denying that experience. And with that acceptance, then I can bring about transformation. This girl that I mentioned, the same process happened with her also, right? She recognized, she understood there was something to do with the experiences of her past. But when she started realizing and feeling that anxiety and that guilt, that gave her a way to progress further. The problem is, without the safety and security of a loving relationship, to face those experiences is very, very difficult. And not all of us can afford therapists. And neither are all therapists good enough, perhaps. Yeah? Including me. So then, of course, in that relationship with the Supreme that we can develop, we have that safe, secure relationship in which we can actually look at some of these experiences that are troubling me, face them, confront them with honesty and cleanliness, accept them, then go into that deep stillness of yoga, of meditation, that extreme stillness, just being a soul in the presence of God. And let that loving relationship, let that loving presence heal the soul. And then there is transformation. And then I return back to the state of fullness. How do we know that there is the state of fullness, first of all? How do we know that? Science doesn't speak about that. We have evolved from various species and we have now become who we are, right? How do we know that there is a state of fullness in the first place?
Happiness.
Happiness? From a long time, many, many centuries, many philosophers have always spoken about this state of fullness. So for, you know, in Greek philosophy, for example, even from the time of Plato, but perhaps even before Plato, but Plato certainly speaks of these images of perfection within. He calls them innate ideas. He says everybody is born with these images of perfection within. And as we're living our life, we're trying to match these images in the mind with reality outside. Yeah? And then throughout that stream of philosophy, we have had many people who have spoken about this. St. Augustine, Plotinus, and then to modern times, Hume speaks of these archetypes in the unconscious, archetypes of perfection that are there, which motivate us, which make us behave in certain ways, because we are looking for that perfection. We want to be that once again. In more experimental, modern psychology, people have had, Abraham Maslow, an American psychologist, he done these studies on peak experiences. I don't know if you're aware of them, but he saw that almost everyone has moments of peak, That is, for no obvious reason, you feel a sense of awe, wonder, love, you feel full. Nothing has happened. It just flows out of you. You feel connected with the whole world. You feel a sense of great mercy and not out of balance, but quite balanced.
Yeah?
Some of you would have had such experiences sometimes. A state of great silence and stillness and love and compassion. And he says there is this essential nature within the human being that is originally pure, perfect, elevated. And it wants to express itself more and more and more and more. But because of our dependencies, temptations, etc., etc., it stays pushed away into our subconscious or unconscious. But now and then it emerges again. In the process of meditation, through these experiences, firstly of recognition, that stillness, and that honesty, and the experience of love, we are creating a healing, because then these experiences can be healed, and the original experience of the soul, that state of fullness, can slowly emerge again. That is the process that we speak about. Any questions, any suggestions, any thoughts at this point? Yes?
I'd be curious about those positive emotions
that
you say also diseases. if we get to this fullness, will we then not feel love and excitement and passion anymore?
We will feel love but not excitement. We will feel enthusiasm but not passion.
Okay.
That is, it becomes more, yeah, exactly. It becomes more balanced, that's all.
Okay.
It's not that the state of fullness is an absence of all nice things in life. That would be a very strange state of fullness. And also in the practice of Raj Yoga, you must understand the process of meditation itself is a little different. In many systems of meditation, they try to take the mind into a state of emptiness. Remove all thoughts and become silent. Raj Yoga, it's totally different. It's actually the opposite. It is not removal of thoughts. It is filling the mind with the right thoughts and creating a state of fullness, which then gives you an experience of silence. When you're full, you're at peace. Right? You had a nice meal, the stomach is full, you want to rest. So when the soul is full, when the mind is full of the positive experiences that I have created, I am at peace. And that silence is full. That is enriching. So this is the kind of silence that we are trying to achieve. So the practice of meditation, but then the practice of meditation not just by itself, but also this process of looking at the self, this process of having that deep honesty with the self, and also, of course, the experience of love and forgiveness for the self and for others, and that experience of love coming in, flowing into the soul from the Supreme, which can give us that strength then to forgive, because then we feel loved. We feel that self-respect. So two of these things, of course, we will speak about, like, for example, the issue of forgiveness we will take up in the next session. The issue of self-respect or self-esteem we will take up in the session after that. In more detail, we will go into the experience of forgiveness as well as the experience of self-esteem. But yes?
I'm not quite sure. With the peaks, what's the difference between peaks and, like, that being a momentary thing, and that concept of self-actualization?
Yes. How I would put it would be the peak experience is an insight into the true nature of the soul. Self-actualization is a process where through a life of committing myself to meaningful experiences, meaningful activities, I bring a state where I am able to naturally experience myself close to that peak, because I have lived according to my potential, I have fulfilled my responsibilities, I have lived according to my inner values, etc. So it's a state that I create. And in the process of creating that state, I'm also moving closer and closer to that peak experience. So then I could have these experiences more frequently in my life. Does it answer your question? So when we are speaking about going back to the state of fullness, it is, not just through sitting and meditating, yes, through meditating, but also through meditation, the insights, the recognition I get about my own values, about my own inner self, I start living according to them, which would mean breaking these attachments and desires, which would mean not giving in to dependencies and temptations. And through that, I return to my state of fullness. I gather back my self-esteem. And through that, I'm able to get closer to that inner experience of fullness, which is the peak. So it's a process. Yes?
Yeah, is it done?
Yeah, I think so. Is there anything else? No? Okay.
I was thinking the meditation you talked about. I
yes.
haven't been into this for a long time, so I forgot how you practice.
We will do it right now.
Okay. but my question is, when you say that we should not remove thoughts, but create good thoughts?
Yes.
How about the bad thoughts that enter?
Yes.
In the meditation? Will you recognize they were here and then... let them go and then think some kind of affirmation or...
Yes, they need to be transformed. Pushing them away, again, is not an answer because I'm just ignoring them. It doesn't really solve the problem. So therefore, knowledge, recognition is extremely important. What is the negativity that is coming? Why is it coming? A little bit of recognition of that is extremely important. And therefore, in this process of meditation, we say that without knowledge... yoga, or the process of connecting with my inner self and with God, is not possible. I need a clear understanding of what is happening, and therefore the recognition. And when there is recognition, then and with honesty, then I can have the experience of stillness through which I experience love, and then the healing happens.
Yeah, but will you think this positive affirmation with your will in the meditation?
Yes, with will, but sometimes it can be very superficial. Mm. And that will not really work. So, for example, say someone has had a very traumatic experience in the past. Say a loss of a very loved one. Say loss of someone's mother. Okay? And that experience is actually weighing on the mind. Right? So what does the spiritual understanding tell us? Spiritual understanding tells us that no one dies. Because the soul never dies. See? The soul just moves on. So there is really no death. And that person that I loved is there. Maybe not in that form, but is there. But I can use this in a very superficial way. So I'm feeling that pain when I think of my mother. And then because I'm very spiritual, I can sit down and I can tell myself, no, no, it's okay. All souls die. And you know, no soul dies, sorry. Freud would say that's a Freudian slip. You know how he would explain that? I'll tell you how he would explain it. He would say, you don't really believe in all this nonsense about the soul. You see, you don't believe in that. Because you don't believe in that, what you're actually saying is that it is the body that is the real thing, not the soul. And therefore the soul always dies. You see, it's come out. Which may actually be true. I'll tell you how it can be true. It can be true because one is the intellectual belief. The other is the faith. And these are two different things. Many times we confuse one for the other. So I may have the intellectual belief that yes, there is a soul and I am the soul and blah, 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 blah. But if I don't really have the experience of being a soul, you see, that faith hasn't developed. So I may be saying all these things, but that faith is not sufficiently deep. And therefore it comes out in this way when I say, all souls will die anyway. Good explanation, isn't it? But it is really true in some ways, huh? Yes? Yes, please.
Help me out on the emptiness part.
Yes.
It seems, are there two types of emptiness then? There's the emptiness which is a sense of something missing.
Yes.
You could say a negative emptiness.
Yes.
But there also seems to be an emptiness which is... I don't know, the absence of stillness.
Yes.
The emptiness that is the quietness of God, where the sine wave of excitement or depression is still.
I get your question. So the emptiness coming out of a state of something missing, and an emptiness that is coming out of a state of actually fullness. So that's the explanation that I think I've already given. There are two ways of approaching that state of emptiness that you're speaking about. One is through emptying the self of every thought, every attachment, finishing it, And so I have a state of quietness, emptiness. And the other process that we speak of in the philosophy of Raj Yoga is creating a state of fullness that will create that stillness. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
So there are distinctly in the process of meditation, there are these two distinct practices of reaching that state, whatever you call it. One is creating a state of emptiness that is not a sense of lacking anything. And the other is creating a state of fullness in which you will not find anything lacking. Most meditation systems, or many meditation systems that I know of, approach it this way. That is, removing attachments, removing dependencies, removing everything and going into what they call the void. Nothingness.
Nothingness. Yeah.
They call that nothingness.
Mm.
Because that is the reality. Mm. That comes from Advaita philosophy of non-dualism.
Mm-hmm.
You merging with the universe. The other process that we speak of in Raj Yoga is not approaching, it's a distinctly different process. Where you are not trying to remove these dependencies, attachments just like that, but you are trying to transform them.
Yeah.
So for example, there is attachment to a relationship.
Yeah.
Instead of breaking that relationship in any way, you are looking at transforming it into love. So this is a very different process. So there is ambition. Instead of removing ambition and throwing it away, you're looking at a process of transforming it and using that fire for the benefit of self and for the world. So there is anger. Instead of just removing anger, you're transforming it through the power of tolerance into a fire that gives you determination. So the process of Raj Yoga is distinctly different in this way, because we're looking at transforming these negative experiences. Not just removing them, but transforming them. The understanding is, the energy is the same. The energy is being used this way, positive or negative. And if it is being used negatively, the only sustainable way of experiencing a state of healing and fullness is transforming the nature of the energy. And this is actually captured in a very interesting symbol from Indian mythology. I don't know if you've seen it. There is a symbol of, you know, Krishna is one of the figures from Indian mythology, supposed to be a child prince with a peacock feather, dark skin, playing the flute, many of you may have seen.
Yeah.
And there is a very famous symbol of him dancing on the head of a snake. Okay? Sometimes they show him dancing on the head of a huge snake with sometimes five heads, sometimes with seven heads, sometimes with nine heads. So he's dancing on the head of the snake. And in some pictures they show him fighting the snake.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of this, so there is the snake and the heads, and he's fighting with the snake, and it goes down like this, and from the tails of the snake there are these five angels
mm-hmm.
that are sort of going down in front of Krishna. In some mythological stories, they're supposed to be the five wives of the snake fellow. But anyway, it's a different. So it's a beautiful symbol that actually is telling us about the process of transformation. So the evil that I am experiencing, all the negativity, the guilt, the anger, the anxiety that I am experiencing, killing it or getting rid of it actually is the process of transforming it into something beautiful, its original form. So the process of Raj Yoga is this deliberate process of transformation, which requires a very clear knowledge, recognition of the original qualities of the soul, and also how to bring about transformation. And obviously that requires some work and some experience and some time. Okay? Yes?
Maybe, I don't know, final question, but I just need a distinct, if you could just help us distinguish between, I mean, when is meditation a good thing if you have a mental illness or mental disease, and when is it not? To me it seems a little bit like you point to meditation as the solution to healing. And it could be in many instances, but I suppose that there would be instances as well where meditation would simply not be...
You are 100% right.
Yeah.
Because obviously when we're looking at healing and any sustainable form of healing,
yeah.
then there has to be some understanding, recognition
mm-hmm.
of why things are happening the way they're happening.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, in many mental disorders, the person is not in a state that is amenable or conducive for actually confronting the self. Or even looking at the self, it is not even possible sometimes. So in such cases, obviously, it is not advisable. However, having said that, Having said that, I have certainly seen cases of even people going through schizophrenic episodes who have benefited from the process of meditation. So I wouldn't say it is yes or no. I would say it depends really on the individual case, on the readiness of the person, maybe some previous experiences the person has had with spiritual practices. It would depend on many things. But certainly it should be used judiciously. It cannot be just given out like that to everyone. Some people may not be ready for it. And also the process of guidance is very, very important. You let people just work on their own, things can actually become quite difficult. So for example, if I don't have the tools of looking at myself, of understanding past experiences, and I just try to make the mind silent, then all these repressed experiences will come out with more force. And they can disturb the soul. So there has to be a guidance, there has to be, yeah. Okay? So shall we stop here and have a little practice of meditation today? So once again, I allow the body to settle down, letting go of any tension that may have accumulated. Feeling the wave of relaxation flowing throughout the body. I gently turn my attention away from the outside world and focus my attention within. Going deep within myself. To the center of my being. To the center of my existence. The soul. The spirit. I experience my entire existence merging into a point of light. A point of eternity. That source of energy that was before this body was. That will be after this body is no more. And stabilized in this experience of the point. I feel myself slipping away from this world of matter. Disappearing from this world of matter into a world of light, into a world of light. And I experience myself to be in the presence of the Supreme. The presence of God, the presence of unconditional love, the presence of infinite peace,
see the light of the Supreme falling upon the soul. Entering the soul. The light, the love, the peace. Healing, purifying. Returning the soul to its original state of fullness and peace. And in the presence of the Supreme Light, in the presence of God, I experience myself to be full, complete, and I hold on to this deep, blissful silence. The silence of fullness. In the eyes of the mind, I see just two beings of light. Two point sources of light. The soul and the Supreme. In silent union, deep stillness, and holding on to the silence, I let myself gently return back to this world of matter. This field of action. Once again, I see myself in this room, seated on this chair, but I hold on to the deep stillness of the spirit within, the deep silence, the deep peace. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Go afternoon.